Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Amateur Traveler, episode 547. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about glaciers and mountains, emerald pools, and helihiking as we take a road trip through the national parks of British Columbia. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler, the award-winning Amateur Traveler podcast, but more on that later. First, let's talk about British Columbia. I'd like to welcome back to the show Carolyn Heller, who is the author of The Moon, Vancouver and the Canadian Rockies Road Trip Guide, which is one of the longest book titles we've had on the show, and has come to talk to us about a road trip in British Columbia. Carolyn, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Chris. Thank you, and thanks for inviting me back.
And I say welcome back. We have done another road trip with Carolyn, and that one was one that I haven't had a chance to do yet, but it is on my to-do list since we talked about it, and that's the one in Ontario, up in more rural and outside of Toronto in some of the interesting and pretty parts of Ontario.
That's right. We talked about a road trip around Georgian Bay in Ontario, but I'm here to talk to you today about another part of Canada.
Please do.
I wanted to talk to you about a road trip in British Columbia near my home base, which is Vancouver. I know a lot of your listeners are probably familiar with Banff and Jasper National Parks mm-hmm. in Alberta in the Canadian Rockies, and I know you've done a couple of those episodes. But I wanted to talk to you today about four more national parks that are on the British Columbia side of the Rocky Mountains. And those parks are Mount Revelstoke, Glacier, Yoho, and Kootenay. And they're all more or less on or off of Highway 1, which is the Trans-Canada Highway. And mm-hmm. so they are quite easy to link together if you have a week or ideally a little bit longer to put together a road trip. They make a good group of destinations altogether.
Excellent. Yeah, I've done this, but it's been a while. I believe I was 15. So.
Oh, wow.
No, sorry. My brother was 60, so I was only 13 when we did this trip. It was the same trip we did Banff and Lake Louise. We looped around through Vancouver on the way home. Although I don't think we spent as much time there as we're going to talk about doing here. So mm-hmm. I'm curious to see what I missed. What do you recommend for an itinerary for this area?
When I did the trip, I actually took 5 weeks and I went from Vancouver all the way through these national parks in British Columbia and up through the Canadian Rockies down to Calgary and then a big loop back to Vancouver. And it was an awesome trip, but you really don't need to take that much time. As I said, if you've got a week to 10 days, you can do a really nice road trip. There's a couple different ways of doing it. One way would be to do it as a one-way trip, starting in Vancouver mm-hmm. and ending in Calgary. You could also do it as a loop, starting either in Vancouver or Calgary. Both of those are the closest major airports. So right. if you were flying into the region, either of those would be good places to start. Just to orient you a little bit, the parks essentially running from west to east. Mount Revelstoke is closest to Vancouver, and that's about a 6.5 hour drive. If you started in Vancouver, it's 350 miles or about 560 some kilometers from Vancouver to the Revelstoke area. If you were coming the other way from Calgary, and the park you'd get to first is Yoho.
which has nothing to do with pirates.
As far as I know, it does not. The name, as I understand it, is an Aboriginal word. I believe it comes from the Cree First Nations people, and I've heard it translated as wonder or awe. I think it's a very fitting name because it is one of the most spectacular of the national parks in British Columbia.
Well, and you say it's just the other side of Banff. It adjacent to Banff. Banff is basically, there's one big park that's Banff on one side of the divide between British Columbia and Alberta, and Yoho on the other side.
That's exactly right. And so from Lake Louise, which is a really popular destination within Banff National Park, it's only about, I think it's about 20 minutes to the entrance of Yoho. So these are also parks that, especially Yoho and Kootenay, are very close to Banff, and that's certainly another way to do it.
It looks like it's 5 miles from Lake Louise to Yoho, so it's really close.
It is really close. It is really close. I mean, if you're talking about coming from the town of Banff to the center of either Yoho or Kootenay, you'd probably want 45 minutes to an hour to drive, but it's definitely day trip distance. And a lot of people do that as part of a Canadian Rockies trip. You can stay in Banff and you can do day trips to at least a couple of the parks, Yoho and Kootenay. Glacier, Mount Revelstoke are a little bit farther to the west, but you're not talking about huge journeys between them.
And why am I going to go here? I mean, we're in the Canadian Rockies, so it's going to be beautiful. I know that already, but it was already beautiful on the other side. So why would I come to
Yoho? It is already beautiful on the other side, and that's a good question. And I guess for me, the things that make the British Columbia parks stand out are they're all surprisingly different. I mean, they're all in the mountains. They all have beautiful lakes. As you said, the scenery is spectacular. But they're all different, and the landscapes in each of them are all a little bit different, and the activities that you can do are a little bit different. I think because they're not quite as popular as a park like Banff, which gets literally millions of visitors every year, it's a little bit easier to get away from the crowds. And well, there certainly are places in each of the BC parks that get crowded, especially in July and August, which is the busy season. I think it is just a little bit easier to get away from the really big crowds. I think another reason to do this kind of trip, this year we're recording this in 2017, which is a big year for Canada. It's Canada's 150th birthday. As part of the country's birthday celebrations, Parks Canada, which runs all the country's national parks, has decided that admission to all Canada's national parks this year will be free. So it's an extra special good time to do a BC National Parks road trip.
Yeah, in terms of less crowded, if you think that Banff doesn't get too crowded, I suggest that someday you do the hike in Johnston Canyon on a busy summer day.
I have done that.
It's not like being out in the wilderness. It's a constant line of people. And so you're saying I won't see that quite as much if I go just even a little bit over to Yoho.
Yeah, you shouldn't. I think of the parks, Yoho definitely can be the busiest.
Well, the easiest to get to, so yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't want to tell you that there aren't going to be crowds, but in general, I think maybe a little bit less crowded. In all of the parks, both on the BC and the Alberta side, there's a lot of highlight locations that everybody goes to. And if you hike even a short distance away from any of those locations, it's relatively easy to find the kind of peace and quiet that you might expect to find in a national park.
Excellent. Well, then in Yoho, what are the highlight locations? And then what are the other ones you would recommend we get to?
Okay. Well, in Yoho National Park, I think one of the highlights definitely has to be Emerald Lake. That's definitely a place that lives up to its name. It's this just really spectacular kind of green turquoise color. If you have a chance to be there at different times of the day as the sun comes across the lake, it changes the colors to all these different shades of blue and green and is just spectacular. I have to say that is one of the places that can get to be the most crowded. So if you do have an opportunity to be there early in the day or in the evening, especially as the sun is going down, that would be the best time to be at Emerald Lake. There's a trail that you can follow that goes around the lake. It's not very long. It's just over 3 miles or about 5 kilometers. you certainly get away from people as soon as you start hiking around the lake. That's another way to get a little bit away from the crowds. You can rent canoes and kayaks and things and get out on the lake too. So that's another just pretty way to spend an afternoon. One of the other lakes in the park that's really popular is Lake O'Hara. And in fact, it's so popular that Parks Canada limits access to it. So you can't drive a private car up to Lake O'Hara. The Park Service runs a bus and you have to make reservations to take the shuttle bus.
And we can make those that day, the day before, weeks in advance?
No, no. You have to do it in advance. And you really have to do it, I think, like as soon as it opens for reservations.
Oh, wow.
I was checking the date for this year, 2017, and it looks like the reservations open on April 20th. I would not delay if I wanted to go to Lake O'Hara. In fact, I wasn't able to go. I couldn't get a reservation when I was on my trip because I wasn't quick enough. So that one is still on my bucket list. But I've definitely talked to a number of people who've been up there who've said it just is really spectacular. And obviously, the nice thing about limiting access to it is if you are one of the lucky people who can get up there and do some hiking around the lake, it's going to be a lot less crowded.
My impression is there's also one of the lodges is at Lake O'Hara.
There is. And so that's another way, I guess, if you can get a reservation up at the lodge. I believe the lodge runs their own shuttle.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
A couple of the other things that I really liked in Yoho, which maybe are not quite as crazy busy, were two of the waterfalls. There's a waterfall on the Kicking Horse River near the west entrance of the park, and it's called Wapta Falls. And there's a really pretty hike. It's about 3 miles or 4.5 kilometers round trip that takes you down to the falls. You can actually get pretty close to them. They're very wide, but not super high. Assuming the river's not really high, you can walk down along the riverbed. So you're almost at the base of the falls, and it's really, really beautiful. There's another waterfall in Yoho National Park that's called Takakaw Falls. In the same way that Wapta is wider rather than high, Takakaw Falls is the opposite. It's higher rather than wide. And in fact, it is considered to be one of the highest waterfalls in Canada. There are several sort of easy trails that you can walk around to get different views of the waterfalls. Access is a little more limited there. It's along the road called Yoho Valley Road. Any kind of a big vehicle, like an RV or camper, is not allowed on the Yoho Valley Road. There's a couple of really sharp switchbacks near the start of the road. It's not difficult to drive in a regular car, but if you're in anything large, I'm not sure you'd make it around the turn. There's a hostel that's very close to the falls. It's the Whiskey Jack Hostel that's part of the Hosteling International Network. And they have a little, I think it's 27-bed hostel that is within sight of Takakaw Falls. So that to me was the main advantage of staying up there. I got up, had a quick breakfast, and then went over to the falls early in the morning. It was beautiful. There was almost nobody there. It was just a really nice way to see the falls. One other thing in Yoho National Park your listeners might be interested in if they're interested in the railroads.
Big Hill.
A big hill. Yeah, exactly.
If you hadn't gone there, I was going to. So
let me explain a little bit about what that was. When the Canadian Pacific Railway was building the Transcontinental Railroad across Canada from east to west, they had to get the railroad through the Rocky Mountains. And as I understand it, the first route that they took through, I think it was Kicking Horse Pass, was really steep. And it went down what, as you said, became known as the Big Hill. It was so much steeper than any other track at the time that the first train that went through derailed. And I think it was three people were killed.
Workers. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
An engineer came up with a different solution, which was called the spiral tunnels, which are these two looping tracks that go in and out of the mountain. And it almost looks like a sort of a roller coaster ride through a magic mountain or something, where there's a mountain in the middle and the train tracks loop in and out of the mountain. Because they loop around, it makes the descent down the big hill much more gradual. So they built the spiral tunnels in 1909, I think was the date that they were finished, and they're still used today. So there are trains that still go through them, and there's a couple points in Yoho National Park where you can see where the tunnels are, and if you're lucky, you'll see a train going through and ducking in and out of the mountain is what it looks like.
That viewpoint is right off the Trans-Canada Highway, right there.
That's right.
Off Route 1. And so we had a chance to see that. I believe we had a chance, if my memory serves, to see a train do that loop.
Yeah.
So you see three different parts of the train. So it's rather odd.
Yeah, it's very cool. I did ask whether there was any kind of schedule that you could follow, like so you know when the trains are coming. And they told me that it wasn't predictable enough. So you just kind of have to be lucky, I guess. It is kind of cool, especially if you're into trains.
Exactly. Well, especially if you're a nerd engineer like me. Excellent. Anything else in Yoho before we move down a little further south?
To talk a little bit about places to stay within the park, there are two lodges that are within the national park. One is right on Emerald Lake, Emerald Lake Lodge, and the other is called Cathedral Mountain Lodge. They both have dining rooms, places to eat, as well as places to stay. Those are both pretty special locations. There is also a little town in the middle of Yoho National Park. The town is called Field, and there's lots of bed and breakfast, people who rent rooms in their homes in Field. And as I mentioned, there's the hostel that's up by Takakoff Falls. The park also has four campgrounds if you're a camper.
Excellent. And then we're going to talk about Kootenay.
Just south of both Yoho and Banff is Kootenay National Park. That is not right on Highway 1, but there is another highway that runs through the park. It's Highway 93 that runs roughly north-south. If you were coming from Banff or Yoho, you would pick up Highway 93 at the north end. One of the first things that you would come to along Highway 93, if you're coming that way, is the Continental Divide. Mm-hmm. There's a marker that tells you that that's the point where to the east, the water flows to the Atlantic. And on the west slopes of the mountains, the water flows to the Pacific. It also is the dividing line between BC and Alberta, I believe. And it, mm-hmm. I think, also is the dividing line between Banff and Kootenay National Park. So as you said, the parks are right up against each other. A little bit farther south in Kootenay National Park, there's a spot called the Paint Pots, which is a kind of unusual natural phenomenon. It's a short walk in from the parking area to these three mineral pools, which have this sort of weird green color, and the land around them is a kind of an orange. It's almost like an orange powder, it looks like. And I guess it comes from the mineral composition of the area, just a sort of really unusual little mineral formation. And it does kind of look like somebody painted it. Another thing, as you drive along Highway 93, that really surprised me is there's a really big section in the north half of the park as you drive along the highway. There's this section is acre after acre of burned trees. Mm-hmm. And I went through there and I'm like, whoa, what happened? It turns out, I guess, back in 2003, there was a lightning strike in the park that set off this huge fire. And apparently it burned for 40 days, more or less. It burned over 40,000 acres of the park. And you can still see as you go through there, it's just, as I said, like row after row of burned trees. Now, a lot of it is growing back. And if you stop and look a little bit more closely, you can see that it is regenerating. Elsewhere in the park, there's actually a really interesting exhibit about the role of fire in the park. One of the rangers was explaining to me that certain types of pines, I believe it is, need fire to reproduce. Mm-hmm. So we think of it as this horrible thing, but it actually does have a natural benefit, particularly when it occurs away from where people are.
Well, and I've seen some programs on it that talk about the science of what we're now understanding about forest fires that we didn't understand when we formed our plans for. Basically, for years, the theory was put out every fire and put it out as soon as possible. And you can see why. It makes the landscape look very different, and tourists don't like it, and all of those sorts of reasons. But the problem is then the brush builds up, and when you do have a fire, instead of it just burning along the ground and burning up the brush and leaving the trees, which is what used to happen most of the time, it will become what they call a crown fire. It will burn up in the tops of the trees and destroy the trees. And so that is something that I know here in the U.S. we have been trying to change our policies in national forests and national parks to deal with fire differently based on what has been learned from that. But it's a tough change.
Yeah, that's interesting.
When Yosemite is on fire, or Yellowstone, or Banff, or Kootenay, or something like that, there is definitely a desire to put that out.
Right. You can see why when you drive through the park and you see what really looks like devastation of the landscape. But it was interesting, and I think the park is doing a good job of trying to explain to people about the pros and cons of fire and what's good about it and how it does help the natural environment. Further south in the park, there's another attraction that's totally different. It's the Radium Hot Springs, which is a natural hot springs pool. That's a wonderful place to just chill. Well, not exactly chill because it's hot, but to relax. They actually have two pools at Radium. There's a cool pool that's more designed if you really want to swim. And then there's a really big hot pool that is designed for soaking. It's surrounded by these really steep canyon walls. I think it's Sinclair Canyon is the canyon that's in the area. It's these big, massive red walls. Near there, the highway actually goes right between the canyon walls. It makes just a really beautiful setting for just being there and soaking in the pools and relaxing.
Now, they're named Radium. They are not, so far as I can see, radioactive.
I believe that is the case. They are not radioactive.
And they're apparently odorless. So you say hot springs, and I immediately thought of sulfur smells and things like that. And that is not the case here, is what I'm
No,
hearing.
They don't have a particular smell. I mean, there's a little bit of a kind of a minerally smell, but no, it's not that rotten egg kind of sulfur smell. It's really, really pleasant. It's a lovely place to be. The other thing that was interesting when I was at the hot springs is just outside of the pools, there were several bighorn sheep grazing. And those are the animals with those curly, like big curled horns. And apparently there's a huge number of them that live both at that end of the park and at the south end of the park. There's a little town that's also called Radium Hot Springs. At certain times of year, the sheep come down into the town. And in fact, I was just driving around exploring the town and happened to go by the golf course. And there were several of these big sheep just right by the road on the edge of the golf course. You may see them pretty close up. That was a surprise to me because I didn't know that there was that type of wildlife in the area.
Well, and I looked it up, and the name of the hot springs does come from small traces of radon, the decay product of radium. Radiation dosage from the bathing in the pools is, quote, inconsequential.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear that.
And it's coming from Wikipedia, so it must be true, right?
Oh, absolutely. One of the other things that was interesting in the area of Kootenay National Park was I stayed in a lodge that's just outside the park that's called the Cross River Wilderness Center. It's a family-owned place. The owners are Robert and Marilyn, and they've run the property for a really long time. Robert is of Aboriginal heritage. His family is Métis, which is a French native mixture. And so they do have a lot of information on the property. They have this really pretty lodge where they often will do different cultural activities where you can learn about local Aboriginal culture. But it's also just a really nice place to stay. They have 8 little cabins, which are off the grid, solar powered, but they all have hot showers and they're really cozy. And there's a big main lodge building where they serve meals family style. And Marilyn and Robert are very often there. So they'll talk to you about the area. I was by myself when I stayed there, and I ended up joining up with another couple that was visiting from the UK to go for a hike. Robert sketched out a route for us that started not too far from the lodge, and we were hiking for the better part of the day, we set out after breakfast, came back in the early afternoon, and we did not see a single other person. If you want to get away from the crowds, that's definitely a good place to do it. The lodge itself is off of a logging road that you get to just outside the park. It's not difficult. You don't need any special kind of car to get through it or anything. It's a dirt road. These big logging trucks sometimes do go by. And there were a couple times where I was driving in or out from the lodge and a truck went by on the other side. And it was as if my car had a dirt shower. I was just literally bathed in the reddish dirt from the road. But other than that, it's a beautiful spot to get away from things, but you're really just outside of Kootenai National Park. I had a chance to do another activity also just outside of Kootenai National Park that was very cool. I spent several days at a hella hiking lodge, hella as in helicopter.
Not as in a hella good place to go hiking.
Well, it is a hella good place to go hiking as well. The company that runs the lodge where I stayed is called CMH Hella. In the wintertime, they're a hella skiing operation where they take you up into the mountains in a helicopter and you ski down. But in the summer, they run helicopter hiking trips. They have a helipad. It's not very far from Radium Hot Springs at the south end of Kootenai National Park. Mm-hmm. They pick you up in their helicopter and they fly you up to one of their lodges. The one I stayed in was called the Bugaboo Lodge because it's in or near Bugaboo Provincial Park.
Okay, just to the west of there. And I don't see any roads that go to Bugaboo Provincial
Park. Well,
that's
the idea.
like no roads at all.
I think there are some kind of back roads that can take you into part of the park, but that's the idea of going in a helicopter, is it takes you to places that you otherwise would not be able to get to, or certainly would not be easily able to get to. There are places you can hike in and things like that. But going in a helicopter, aside from being very cool, is a way to get to very remote places that you otherwise wouldn't do. CMH, I believe, was the first company to do heli skiing in that area. They're one of a few companies now that does helicopter-based hiking. Yeah, so they fly you into the lodge and then during the day take you in the helicopter with a guide and a group of other hikers, and they leave you somewhere remote and you hike around for a while, and then the helicopter comes back and picks you up and takes you to somewhere else and you hike around for a while, and then the helicopter comes back and picks you up. And
so we're not talking a budget sort of experience, I'm guessing here.
No, this is definitely not a budget experience. But it is a pretty special kind of thing. Mm-hmm. They do trips as short as, I think, 3 days is their shortest trip. So it's something that you could get sort of a little taste of. If you're on a backpacker budget, you're probably going to want to pass this one by. But if you are looking for a really special way of getting up into the mountains, definitely an awesome, awesome adventure. And it is nice sometimes, too, to have the chance to hike with a guide who can tell you about the area and point out a little bit about what you're seeing and take you to different parts of the parks that you definitely wouldn't just stumble upon on your own. You do have to learn a lot of helicopter safety things to get in and out of the helicopter. The helicopters they use, I think, seat about 12 or 15 people. So they're not super tiny. And we had to learn to do what they call the heli huddle. Everybody who's getting into the helicopter crouches down mm-hmm. in a huddle, like a football huddle, mm-hmm. so that you're all together and that you're all low to the ground when the helicopter comes in. So you're safely out of the way of the propellers. And also it makes it easier for the pilot to see everybody because you're all together in one mass of brightly colored hiking jackets and backpacks. It also protects you. There is quite a bit of wind from the propellers of the helicopter. That was something I was not really aware of.
Well, and in terms of pricing, I'm seeing pricing starting at about $4,000 per person for a 7-day trip. I'm not seeing the pricing on their site for the 3-day trips, but I would assume it'd be commensurate.
Yeah, so it'd be, so it'd be a little bit less than that. But that does include, I believe, all of your meals and activities mm-hmm. and your helicopter transportation, and really special trip. It's a beautiful part of the world to do it in.
Oh, here you go. $2,500 for the 3-day heli hiking.
Yeah. Okay. There you go. Okay, the next park I wanted to talk about is Glacier National Park, which is to the west of Yoho.
Not to be confused with the park of the same name in the U.S. or Waterton Glacier National Park, which is in Alberta.
That is correct. Mm-hmm. That is correct. It is a little bit confusing that there are multiple parks with similar names. This one is Canada's Glacier National Park mm-hmm. in British Columbia. It's right along Highway 1. It's west of Yoho and northwest of Kootenay. If you were sort of looping in the direction that we were going, where we were in Yoho and then we went to Kootenay, and then if you wanted to go back up to Glacier, Highway 95 branches up to mm-hmm. the northwest. And that takes you first to the town of Golden, which I just wanted to mention because it is a good base if you wanted to be on the BC side of the mountains and stay somewhere where you could easily get to several of the parks. Mm-hmm. It's a small town in the middle of the mountains. It's kind of Yoho on one side and Kootenay on the other and Glacier to the west. It also has all kinds of adventure things to do. I think it's known most for its whitewater rafting along the Kicking Horse River. Depending on the time of year you go, there's some pretty adventurous whitewater rafting you can do.
And so the Kicking Horse River is the one that Highway 1 is coming down from Yoho along the Kicking Horse River Valley.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I had a chance to, instead of doing a hardcore whitewater trip, one of the companies in Golden, the Glacier Raft Company, which does do all kinds of different rafting adventures, mm-hmm. one of the things they do are these inflatable kayak tours, mm-hmm. which they do as you're getting close to sunset on a really calm part of the river. So that's just another option for being out on the water if you want to do something that you feel like you're getting a little bit of exercise, but you're not getting drenched by the by the current at the rougher end of the Kicking Horse. The other reason to be in and around the Golden area is the Kicking Horse Mountain Resort is a ski area in mm-hmm. the wintertime, and it's open in the summer for all kinds of different outdoor adventures. They have a whole network of hiking trails. They have a Via Ferrata, which I don't know if you talked about on your show before.
No.
So a Via Ferrata is a way to go rock climbing without having to be trained as a rock climber. I guess maybe that's the sort of simple way to explain it.
In a safe way. Not just a really bad way to do rock climbing. Okay.
Yes, yes. In a safe way. Exactly. Exactly. So it's an introduction to rock climbing. I didn't have a chance to do the Ferrata at Kicking Horse, but I did try one both at Whistler, closer to the mm-hmm. BC coast.
Sure.
And there's also one at Banff that I had a chance to do. I'm not super mountain girl or anything like that. So I have to say I was a little bit apprehensive. The one I did first was at Whistler. One of my daughters convinced me to do it. Basically, the way that it works is it's a series of iron rungs. I believe the word comes from an Italian for iron way. So they essentially drill these iron hand and foot holds into the rock. You're clipped in. They run a cable system between these footholds and all along the route where you're climbing. So you wear a harness and you're clipped into the cable, and the cabling is set up so that each section of the cable isn't more than maybe 5 or 6 feet long. And then there's a stopping place where the cable's held into the rock. So the idea is, in the highly unlikely event that you were to slip and fall, you're connected to the cable, and the longest distance you could fall would be within that short segment of the cable. And so as you climb, one of the things that they teach you how to do is how to clip and unclip yourself.
Because you've got two clips, I'm guessing.
Yes, exactly. You have two clips. So you're always clipped in with one at least at a time. And then as you go around each of the anchor points where the cables are attached, you unclip from one side, clip on the other side, then unclip your second cable and clip in again on the other side.
So that also means that going is relatively slow.
Yes, yes. It is not a fast adventure. Mm-hmm.
But it's going to look like I'm slowed down just because I'm clipping and unclipping, not because I'm catching my breath climbing this rock. So that's good.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I felt like it was a workout. Mm-hmm. It's not quite as much of an aerobic workout. It does take some strength to mm-hmm. be maneuvering yourself around the rocks. I have to say, it's not a thing I would recommend to somebody who has any fear of heights, because you are kind of hanging up there from mm-hmm. a rock. Looking down a long way down would freak you out. Then maybe this isn't the best activity for you. But as long as you're okay with heights and you have a sort of reasonable level of physical fitness, that's the idea, is that you should be able to do an activity like this. The other thing that I did when I was up at Kicking Horse was they have a grizzly bear center where they have a bear named Boo, who was orphaned as a cub, and they brought him to live on essentially the side of the ski hill, where he's got 20 acres to roam around. You can go up and have a look at him, and they'll tell you a lot about bears and bear habits. And he's a pretty big bear. I saw him in August. He was pretty well on his way to his hibernation weight, which I believe they told me was on the order of 750 pounds, 350 kilograms, I guess. When I saw him in August, I want to say he was maybe 100 pounds shy of that. He's in an enclosed space, but if you're lucky, he'll come close to the fenced area so you can get a pretty good look at him. Yeah, and it was interesting. I just learned a little bit about bears and what they eat and how they live and how much they weigh. See, that's just open from the spring through the fall because he's hibernating in the winter. You'll see him when he comes out to feed in the summertime.
Hmm. With Glacier, we haven't really talked about what you would do in the park yet, right?
Okay, yeah. We haven't even gotten to the park yet. Yeah, because we're still east of the park in the town of Golden. You're pretty close to the park at that point. Mm-hmm. The east gate of Glacier is about 35 miles, 55 kilometers or so from the town of Golden. Highway 1 runs directly through Glacier National Park. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of places that you can just pull off the highway and go for a hike. One of the things that was most interesting to me was sort of in the center of the park, right along Highway 1, is the Park Visitor Center at Rogers Pass. And they have lots of different exhibits about the park and the animals and things like that that live in the area. But what was most interesting to me was I watched a movie that they have there about avalanche control. And the movie was called The Snow Wars. It was basically about how to keep the highway clear when it runs through these high mountains. And in the winter, it just gets dumped on with snow, and how also to set off controlled avalanches so that they're not occurring, you know, when and where people are. And so they had this movie in the visitor center that was actually made in the 1970s. So some of it is pretty hilarious when you see the hairstyles and the mustaches and the communications technologies that they're using. But they explain to you about how they tracked the movement of the snow and how they decide when to set off an avalanche and how they use these military guns mm-hmm. in order to trigger an avalanche. And so I watched this whole movie. Then I went and talked to one of the rangers and I said, you know, that was really interesting, but how do they do it now? Like, this was made in the 70s. And she said, well, they really do it the same way.
Except with less sideburns.
Exactly. Exactly. Probably not so many mustaches either. Right. I mean, the technology is a little bit different, but they still use the same big guns and they still follow essentially the same process. So I was really surprised to learn that. There was not a ton of snow in the park when I went through in August, although there still is snow on the top of the mountains. I didn't get a chance to see it in the middle of the winter.
And you mentioned getting off the highway and going for a hike. Favorite hikes you would recommend?
I have to say, in Glacier, I didn't get a chance to do a ton of hiking. That was the one day that I was in all of these parks where I had bad weather. It was really rainy. I did do a couple of short hikes, but I have to say I didn't really get a chance to fully explore the different options in the park. Glacier does butt up against almost to Mount Revelstoke National Park. And there's mm-hmm. a couple of hikes that I did do right on Highway 1 that are actually just on the Mount Revelstoke side of the park.
Okay.
And they were both really easy little boardwalk trails that are just good, like if you wanted to stretch your legs or something mm-hmm. as you're walking along. One of them is called the Skunk Cabbage Boardwalk Trail.
Okay.
and it gets its name from these giant cabbage-like plants that apparently at certain times of year, I believe it's the spring, they give off a rather particular odor. I was there, as I said, in August, and I wouldn't say they were especially smelly, but I haven't been there in the spring, so that would be when you'd really need to test it out.
Well, I remember from reading in the book Guns, Germs, and Steel, it was talking about the Americas and what kind of crops the indigenous people had, the First Nations, if we're up in Canada.
Oh, yes,
and
yes.
Skunk cabbage was a major portion of their diet up until other crops got introduced, like maize used to be really, really small. It used to be the size of your thumb, so it wasn't that great a food crop. But once other things came in, like beans and things like that, skunk cabbage was the first thing they stopped eating. It's like, that stuff is bad.
I'm not surprised. Yeah.
Do we have anything else, Mom? No. Eat your skunk cabbage. So.
Well, there's another trail nearby. Again, it's just on the Mount Revelstoke side of the national park's boundaries. It's a little less aromatic, or a little more pleasantly aromatic, I guess I would say. It's called the Giant Cedars Boardwalk Trail. Mm. As it sounds like, it takes you through kind of a rainforest-like trail with these super tall cedar trees, some of which I understand are 500 years old, more or less. So they're maybe not quite as old as some of the ones we have out here on the BC coast, but they're pretty old and they're pretty tall. That's a nice trail, especially if you're with kids. It's not a very long trail. You can get out of the car and really quickly see some big trees.
Now, the one thing I haven't heard you say, which I expected because of the name of the park, I haven't heard you talk about any glaciers.
Well, yeah, and that certainly is how the park gets its name. On the tops of the mountains, there are a lot of glaciers. Because I was there on such a rainy day, unfortunately, I didn't really even get to see them. The tops of the mountains were all in the clouds. I feel like I didn't really have a true glacier experience because I did just happen to get one little patch of bad weather.
Well, the reason I ask is I'm curious because I know in Alberta, where I've spent more time, that there's a lot of those glaciers have receded. So I didn't even know if there would be still any in the park.
I think there still are, certainly at the higher elevations. It's very cold. There's certainly mountains all through the parks with the glaciers on the top. I don't think they have any places, like I know, as you're saying, in the Alberta parks, along the Icefields Parkway mm-hmm. between Banff and Jasper, where there's lots of glaciers there, and a place where you can actually take a walk on the Athabasca Glacier. I don't think Glacier National Park, as far as I know, has any places like that where you can get mm-hmm. quite so close to the ice.
Okay. Yeah, no, it does seem to have large active glaciers, it says, and one of Canada's largest cave systems.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I didn't get a chance to see that.
I don't know that you can tour them, but...
yeah. Interesting.
I'm not seeing any indication that I can get into a cave there, but there is apparently a very large cave system.
Hmm.
You need to be a speleologist and have a permit.
Ah, okay. Okay. Yeah, so maybe it's not something you can just kind of casually do. And you continue going west from Glacier National Park. We were just on the eastern side of Mount Revelstoke National Park. And that park kind of almost sort of two different sections. There's the area to the east that we were just talking about that has some hiking trails just off of Highway 1. But the part of the park that I think is the most spectacular is the area that is called the Meadows in the Sky.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a road, the Meadows in the Sky Parkway, that climbs up. The road itself runs 16 miles, 26 kilometers. And you climb up from an elevation of about 1,300 feet, 400 meters, up to more than 6,500 feet, 6,500 feet, or about 2,000 meters in the space of the 16 miles. You're definitely climbing, switchback, climb, switchback, climb, switchback as you go up and down. Again, it's not a difficult road to drive. You clearly have to pay attention because it's very windy. It's kind of a fun road if you like to do that kind of driving. A couple of the interesting things for me was actually how long ago the road was built. It was built in the early 1900s. I think they started construction in 1911, finished in the 1920s. The park itself, I think, was established in 1914. So they were still building the road when they decided that the area should become a national park. And the reason for going up this road, other than that it's a fun drive, is that it takes you up towards the summit of the mountains where there's a whole bunch of hiking trails up there. The road actually stops about a kilometer, about half a mile from the summit. So you leave your car and you can either walk up the rest of the way. It's not very steep at that point, or they run a shuttle bus that goes from the parking lot up to the top. They're just trying to sort of keep too many cars out away from the summit area. Then once you get to the top, there's a whole bunch of different hiking trails that you can choose from. I did a couple of just sort of really short trails. There's one called the Fire Tower Trail, which is a short climb that goes up to an old fire tower cabin that used to be fire tower lookout. Somebody would live in there and keep a watch out for forest fires. And apparently it was used until the 1980s when it was replaced by technology. But the little cabin is still there, and you do have really beautiful views from up there because you're kind of perched up on the top of a hill and you can see a lot of the area around you. And there's another really short, easy trail from the summit area that's called the First Footsteps Trail. Mm-hmm. And that's set up to, so you learn a little bit about the First Nations people in the area. It has a bunch of different interpretive panels and different artworks that were done by local Aboriginal artists. Mm-hmm. So that's another sort of really short, it's about half a mile or about a kilometer that loops you along. There's several more longer trails. So if you wanted to do like a whole day hike, there's several different trails that you can do from up there that would take you sort of a good part of the day. I think there's also a place that you can go and like if you want to camp out along the way. There's no campgrounds in the park that you can drive to. There's no like road accessible camping, but there are places where if you're backpacking, you can hike in and hike back out from the summit area of the parkway. The parkway isn't open that much of the year. I think that the months they say, you know, it's kind of guaranteed to be open is July through September. So it's a pretty short season. I guess there's can be too much snow for a lot of the rest of the year. There's a gatehouse at the bottom, and so they'll tell you if it's not open.
Excellent.
I guess I just wanted to mention a couple of things. If you are going to Mount Revelstoke, as I said, there's no place to stay right inside the park, mm-hmm. but there is the town of Revelstoke is just outside of the park area, and there are lots of places to stay in that town. It is also a ski town in the winter. Revelstoke Mountain Resort is just on the edge of town. There's a really nice hotel that is at the base of the mountain. The Sutton Place is at the base of the ski hill. And there's a bunch of places to stay and eat in the town. The other reason to stop off in Revelstoke, we were talking before about the Transcontinental Railroad, and Revelstoke also had a role in the railroad history. The last spike, they call it, of the Transcontinental Railroad was driven into the railway just to the west of Revelstoke. It's about 25, 28 miles west, 40, 45 kilometers west of Revelstoke was the place where they met coming from the east and coming from the west in the 1885, I think. So Revelstoke has a really nice railway museum where you can both learn about the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad. And then outside of the museum itself, they have a rail yard with a bunch of old train cars, some of which you can climb on. So again, if you're a train buff or if you have kids who are interested in trains, that would be a good place to stop just outside of the park.
I am, in fact, a train buff, so.
Okay.
Well, in fact, for people who are a train buff too, the other thing to think about is you're right on the area that is still covered by one of, I have not done this trip yet, but I would love to do it someday, is the Rocky Mountaineer, which goes from Vancouver up to the Canadian Rockies, really right along this path that we've been describing.
That's true. That's true. I have not had a chance to do the Rocky Mountaineer either. I did do Via Rail, which is the Canadian National Railroad passenger system, runs a train that goes from Vancouver to Jasper and then continues east to Toronto. It's their Canadian flagship train line. So that also does run through the same area.
Mm-hmm. Right.
It's a really beautiful way to see the region. Unfortunately, it doesn't stop in any of these national parks until you get to Jasper on the Alberta side. But yeah, but you're sort of going right along through that area, and it's a really spectacular trip.
You promised us four parks. You have delivered four parks. Is there anything else you want to add to that road trip before we get on the other end to Vancouver?
No, I think that should do it.
Excellent. Couple then overview questions as we go to wrap this up, and this is going to be the hardest one. You're standing in the prettiest spot in all of the places you've named. Where are you standing? What are you looking at?
Oh, yeah, that one is really hard because there are so many places that are just beautiful. I guess I have to say Emerald Lake, and especially if you were on the shores of Emerald Lake late in the day as the sun is starting to go down. I have to say that was probably the prettiest place that I had a chance to see.
Excellent. One thing that surprised you about the area?
Actually, the biggest surprise to me was on my helicopter hiking adventure, and that was how small of a space that a helicopter needs to land. There was that one point where we were hiking, and basically we came up to what was essentially a big rock that was probably about the size of a queen-sized bed. It was a big flat rock. But, you know, I could have stood in the middle of it and stretched my arms out from one side to the other, and I would have pretty much been able to touch, you know, all the sides of the rock. Maybe it was a tiny bit bigger than that, but not much. That's where the helicopter landed, came in to pick us up. I was like, wow, that was a surprise.
Finish this thought. You really know you're in the British Columbia part of the Canadian Rockies in this area when what?
When you wake up in a town called Golden and know that you could get to six different national parks that day in both BC and Alberta.
Okay. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in Eastern British Columbia.
One thing that makes me laugh. Well, that might be how much a bear can eat.
And how much can a bear eat? Obviously, if it's getting to that kind of weight.
A lot. I guess it's kind of how much a bear can weigh.
Yeah.
When we were talking about the grizzly bear center, I never really thought about how big a bear gets over the course of the summer when they're trying to fuel up for their hibernation.
I'm at my hibernation weight, maybe something you hear me say in the future, but... And finally, if you had to summarize this area in just three words, what three words would you use?
How about mountains, hiking, and spectacular.
Excellent. Our guest again has been Carolyn Heller. And Carolyn, where can people read more about your travels?
Well, I have a website at cbheller.com. I would also like to direct people to my book, Moon Vancouver and the Canadian Rockies Road Trip, which can tell you a lot more details about these national parks and other adventures in the area. The easiest way to find that is at my publisher's site, which is moon.com.
Excellent. Well, Carolyn, thank you so much for coming on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your further love for road trips in Canada.
Okay, thank you very much, Chris. I've enjoyed it.
In news of the community, I mentioned at the beginning of the show that The Amateur Traveler was an award-winning podcast. Now, it had won awards before, but it did just win another award, which is one from the National Association of Travel Journalists.
They have three awards they give out each year in the audio category, the audio broadcast category. So that's podcasts, but it's also all the radio shows. And the gold went to Amateur Traveler. So I was pretty pleased with that. Even more pleased because the bronze went to a little show called NPR Morning Edition. I've heard they're pretty good also. Reminder, we've got two trips coming up for Amateur Traveler this year, a trip to Japan in June, as well as the trip to India in November. That's 2017, for those of you who are listening to the show later on. And you can find information on that on the website at amateurtraveler.com. With that, we're going to end this episode of AmateurTraveler.com. I would encourage you to rate this podcast. You can go to iTunes to rate it by going to AmateurTraveler.com/iTunes. And thanks so much for listening.